Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Quigley, who's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for the Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Intervention Since World War II. He has an article at the Cambridge Journal for International and Comparative Law, Finding a Way Forward for Crimea. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Quigley.
Thank you very much.
And clearly with the impending vote in the Crimean Parliament, which is very pro-Russian, this would seem on the face of it, and it's certainly been the reaction from the West, that it's illegal. I mean, Crimea is, after all, a part of Ukraine. So how do you get out of this bind?
Well, the question of the status of a territory and its affiliation isn't limited to the law of the state in which, you know, that territory finds itself. When the Albanians in Kosovo wanted to secede from Serbia, you know, that was not lawful under the law of Serbia, but NATO went and bombed Serbia to ensure that they would be able to separate. So the Prime Minister of Ukraine is certainly saying that this is unlawful under the Ukrainian constitution, and that's probably correct, but that's not the end of the story. You do have the concept of self-determination, and if you have the population of Crimea voting, as it likely will, to secede from Ukraine, that makes it very difficult for the Western leaders to insist that they not do that, because at that point it's not Mr. Putin versus the West, it's the population of that territory.
Well, but the analogy you gave with Kosovo would indicate that NATO bombed Serbia out of the picture and thus changed the rules, and in this case, Russia sent its special forces in and changed the rules. I mean, neither case is a particularly savory one, is it?
Well, you're right. In both instances, there was use of force. I think it was probably more destructive in the Serbia case. I mean, there were people killed by the bombing. It was a major bombing campaign that went on for some time. But the basic issue is whether a population that wants to secede from wherever it is has the right to do that. And that isn't solely a question of domestic law.
Yeah, but this is not a question of the people spontaneously in Crimea, spontaneously waking up one morning and deciding they want to leave Ukraine and join Russia. There was a military, I don't know whether you could call it an invasion, because they have a substantial force on the ground, but there's no question that Russia moved militarily to annex this territory, and they are basically acting as though this is a de facto situation. And even though the tensions between the Russians and the Ukrainian soldiers seem to be subsiding a little, it's a fait accompli, isn't it?
Well, it is, in that sense, yes, the case that the Russian military is occupying, which means that that there is a possibility of factual separation from Ukraine. But the sentiment in the territory, the sentiment in Crimea, has been very steady for a long time. When I was there, as you were mentioning, I was there on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in 1994. And the Crimean parliament people were saying to me then the same thing that they're saying today, namely that they do not want to be part of Ukraine and they would like to find a way to affiliate with Russia. So this is a longstanding sentiment that predates the recent military activity.
Again, I'm speaking with John Quigley, who's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University. He also has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe. And his books include Basic Laws on the Structure of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and Ruses of War, American intervention since World War II, and he has an article at the Cambridge Journal on International Comparative Law, Finding a Way Forward for Crimea. But when you were there for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe in 1994, that was when the Budapest Agreement was signed between the United States, the UK, Russia, and Ukraine, guaranteeing Ukrainian sovereignty over Crimea and what is the rest of Ukraine. And that was in exchange for removing nuclear weapons, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, that was an agreement. There is some question about the character of that agreement, whether it's an actual treaty, an obligation kind of document, or whether it's more a statement. The United States, actually, in referring to the Budapest agreement, does not put it in the category of treaty. But that said, it does say that the parties, including Russia, will respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine. It doesn't specify Crimea, but that was implied. But here you have a situation where the population of this piece of territory, which after all was Russian since the 18th century, where the population says it wants to secede from Ukraine. So it seems to me that it takes it out of the Budapest Agreement.
So what is then the way forward that you're offering, John Quigley?
Well, I'm not sure what the way forward is. Back in 1994, the Russian government was not willing to go to the length of saying that they would take Crimea. Now it appears that might occur. There's been activity in the Duma in Moscow just within the last 24 hours in the direction of legislation that might facilitate this. Mr. Putin hasn't said yay or nay on the matter. So it could be that this will happen. Short of that, it seems to me that there should be some firm guarantees for autonomy for Crimea within Ukraine if it doesn't work out that there will be a separation. There also seems to me there need to be some guarantees for the Tatar population in Crimea, which is a minority. It's the indigenous population from which the Russians actually took the place over back in the 18th century. And they are not happy about the possibility of affiliation with Russia. They will likely boycott the referendum vote when it occurs on, I think, now scheduled for March 16. But I've had contact with them as well. They have a little parliamentary assembly of their own that they call a Majlis. And they would need to have some assurance that they would be protected if Crimea becomes part of Russia.
Well, they have a pretty unfortunate history, do they not, the Tatars? I mean, when Hitler invaded, they were persecuted. And then when Stalin retook the territory, he decided that they were all traitors and moved them off into the middle of nowhere, where many or most of them died, and then they were eventually repatriated, and they make up to 15% of the population. And they are clearly not particularly, they're certainly not pro-Soviet, and I'm not sure how pro-Russian they are.
Yes, I think they're definitely not pro-Russian. They have been much friendlier to the Ukraine government. It's the Ukraine government that has facilitated their repatriation into Crimea. The history, as you recited it, is quite accurate and not very pleasant. And that didn't do anything to make the Tatars appreciate the Russians anymore.
So, I mean, this is obviously not the way to do business, is it? My understanding, I spoke with a reporter in Crimea yesterday whose hotel was surrounded by Russian thugs who were screaming all kinds of racist epithets against Obama and harassing UN and foreign UN officials and foreign journalists. So the tensions are pretty high, and you've got soldiers facing each other across the Crimean-Ukrainian border, apparently. My sense is that, you know, this is pretty reckless brinksmanship. You know, this is almost like the Guns of August. You know, somebody could firing the wrong shot, and it could really turn ugly.
That's certainly possible, and a great danger in the situation. And it is unfortunate that the group from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe was not allowed in, as apparently just within the last 24 hours they tried to enter. They're being put there largely, I think, at the request of the United States, and their aim is to monitor. I would hope that they might be able to play a role beyond monitoring in order to help facilitate some communication among the different groups, among in particular to deal with the Majlis of the Tatars, and perhaps help to bring about some reconciliation, I mean, not only in Crimea, but in the rest of Ukraine as well.
Well, my understanding is that Putin largely did this on the advice of his generals, not on the advice of his diplomats or the oligarchs. And so he took the military imperative over other economic and diplomatic considerations, because his generals were saying to him, this new government in Ukraine is not on our side, and you're going to end up with NATO right on the Crimean border. And we don't know how long the base agreements, the lease is going to be honored. So we got to go in there and grab this territory. That's my understanding of what happened.
I think that's essentially accurate, that there is concern that the base agreement will be nullified on the Ukrainian side. There was also the law that was adopted by the Ukraine parliament to revoke the prior law that had provided for minority languages being official languages in sectors of
right,
Ukraine.
Right, but that was subsequently rescinded.
It was subsequently rescinded, but it did happen, and it was during the time before it was rescinded that you found the Russian action commencing. So there is concern on the part of the Russian speakers, and they're looking to Mr. Putin for some kind of support.
So is there, I've asked you this question before, is there a way out? What I see happening now, the positions hardening and the U.S. and Europe now talking about sanctions, revoking visas. We could get into a situation fairly soon where Putin may reciprocate by turning off the natural gas tap. Although that, of course, will affect his revenues from Europe, but it will certainly impact Ukraine. Putin's already suggested that the Ukrainians are going to have to pay more for gas, and we know that they're bankrupt because the Yanukovych regime looted the treasury. So what's your sense of the direction things are heading?
You know, I don't have a good sense of the direction. If you're asking me to predict where things will actually go, I don't expect that... That Russia will back down on this readily. So we might get into a situation where Crimea does separate and where sanctions are put in place, and we're just going to have a standoff for a period of time. The sanctions so far are fortunately the kinds of sanctions that can be revoked on short notice, and I think Mr. Obama has indicated that. So there is room for some movement there. But I'm not sure what Mr. Putin is likely to do that will lead Mr. Obama to want to lighten the sanctions.
And we don't haven't heard anything yet about what's come out of Paris, where the foreign ministers are meeting, the Russian, the French, the British and American. So the one thing that I've seen is that the U.S. Or NATO is sending 6 F-15 fighter jets to Lithuania. I wonder what the hell that's going to do.
Yes, yes. I don't know how that's going to change anybody's calculation.
So what would change people's calculation, do you think?
Well, I mean, if some really serious move were taken by the West, but that really isn't in the cards. There's certainly nothing militarily. The Europeans don't want to take any significant anti-Russia action in the economic front, which leaves the United States as the only one that might do that, but that wouldn't be very effective if it's only the United States. So I think, you know, Mr. Obama is really between a rock and a hard place.
And how much is Putin between a rock and a hard place? Because if I've been told that if Russians spill Ukrainian blood, that will backfire and blow up in his face, because this military incursion, which has so far been limited to Crimea, is not popular back home in Russia, and it would become very quickly unpopular if it turned sour.
I think that's right. I think he would be in some difficulty if he winds up taking action, or if action happens spontaneously or accidentally. I think he's tried to be rather cautious in that regard so far, but you're right, it could blow up.
So I guess I'm sort of flaying about here, John Quigley, trying to figure out, you know, how we can, you know, in the short term, avoid a horrible tragedy, even though it looks like Putin's made a power play, and so far he's winning, I guess, but it could turn, as we've just mentioned, it could blow up in his face. But, you know, there's a sort of predictable Cold War kind of dynamic setting in here, which I find incredibly depressing. You know, during the Cold War, our punishment to Russia was to isolate them and not talk to them. And we seem to be repeating that. So that is not a useful dynamic.
No, it isn't. And it's more difficult now because we're not any longer in the Cold War situation. There's much more connection between Russia and the West.
Well, just in closing then, John Quigley, is there anybody that you can identify to our audience that you think is making any sense on the international stage that could step in here and, you know, give some adult supervision?
Well, the chair of the OSCE, who also happens to be the foreign minister of Switzerland, has been saying some rather cautious but rather good things. That is, he would like to get more involved, I think, in bringing the parties together. Whether that you know can be effective, I don't know. But if you're looking for a sane voice in the situation, that might be one.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Quigley.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Quigley, who's a professor emeritus of law at Ohio State University and previously a research scholar at Moscow State University and a research associate in comparative law at Harvard Law School. He has dealt with conflicts between Ukraine and Russia after the breakup of the USSR on behalf of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and his books include Basic Laws on the Structures of the Soviet State, Law After Revolution, and The Ruses of War, American Intervention Since World War II. He has an article at the Cambridge Journal of International and Comparative Law, Finding a Way Forward for Crimea. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the shameful vote in the U.S. Senate that scuttled Obama's nominee for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division.